Well, as I said last week, we talked about remembering the poor, and the fact is that you, as a Christian, if indeed you are a Christian, you have a moral obligation to pay attention to and respond to the needs of the poor. And we went through the Old Testament and showed you how often God talks about this very thought. It's a theme of Scripture. In fact, the more you study it, the more you see it everywhere. It's one of those things that keep popping up all over the place once you get your antenna, if you will, to focus on the subject. But we never really define who the poor are or the actual circumstances of those who are in need. And I figured that we would save that for this lesson. We cited the examples of the poor and helpless in the Old Testament, widows without income, orphans without daily provisions, people who are so impoverished that they have no recourse but to beg and depend upon charity. We said things very generally as that. And such situations, and this has been the case for most of human history, such situations are at a time when there was no central government enacting a welfare program or handing out food stamps or providing public housing or offering any social services. So in this lesson here, we're going to look at both sides. And it's going to look like I'm kind of, you know, slanting toward one at first, but then we're going to come back and we're going to start balancing this out. All right, so stay with me. And like I said, I've given you some extra notes in there because this is a subject that needs some objective examination and, yes, some clarification. And this lesson attempts to do both and hopefully to give both sides provide both sides to a long neglected subject. Let me start out by saying that the words poor and poverty can be highly misleading in themselves because they're not always fixed on a universal fixed standard. And it's similar to the word suffering. When you talk about suffering, people take it differently. People suffer differently. How do you fix a universal aspect of suffering? Well, it really depends on who you ask. In other words, one's private interpretation. One person suffers dearly over a toothache. Another person shrugs it off, doesn't have any problem. One person deals with a tragedy in one way, and another person deals with it, you know, considerably more graphically or more dramatically than another. And the other aspect is not only that one's private interpretation, but also motive. You know, why is the question being asked? Is there a hope of compensation? Is there a hope of, you know, some profit from that? Are you suffering in order to get something else? And that sort of thing. So motive plays a part in that as well as one's own interpretation. So I'm saying that as we go into the subject of poor and poverty because the same things apply. Well, it depends on who you ask, and then also depends upon motive as to how you determine who the poor are. According to the United States Census, we are told that 35 million Americans live in what is called poverty. But that's based on actual income earned. I think more accurately is to say that's based on actual income reported. And it does not take into account a number of other factors. And it gives no specific data or description of actual living conditions. It just says, here's a number, and these people fall into that number. The fact of the matter, though, is that 43% of those who are deemed poor actually own their own homes. That's nearly half of that group. And less than 0.1% of all Americans are actually homeless on a permanent basis. The figures vary. I've seen the low at about 240,000, and I've seen the high at about 750,000. People are permanently homeless, on the streets, have nowhere to go, in America, every day. And you think, that's a pretty big number. And until you start looking at how many people are in America, there's 300 million people in America. And so the percentage is actually quite low. I'm not trying to minimize those people's in this situation. I'm just simply trying to show you that, you know, it's not as grim and dire as it might look up front. And some people do suffer temporary food shortages, like when their food stamps run out or something like that, or there's, as some say, there's more month than there is money, that sort of aspect to it. But relatively few people are unable to get enough food to eat in this country. In fact, many of those who are deemed poor actually eat out several times a month. That doesn't mean they eat out at really nice restaurants, but they still eat out. And so you have to take that into consideration as well. The Census Bureau says that poverty is $21,756 a year or lower. Well, that's, again, coming down to numbers that are known or at least reported. but it doesn't include indirect income, indirect services, and indirect opportunities, such as state or federally funded programs, earned income tax credits, that EIC thing you see on your 1040 form, food stamps, WIC programs, women, infants, and children programs is what I'm referring to there, public housing, Medicaid, scholarships, grants for education. There's a lot of things out there. I'm not saying that all poor people are, have those things, but I'm saying that those things are out there and that there's a real drive, if you will, to take care of those people. In fact, in 2012, and this is significant, I think, to think about, in 2012, the U.S. government spent $750 billion basically on the poor. That's $750 billion that the government is spending for those people who are in that category. Now, I was starting to think about this. How much is the government spending on me for my category? And really, what I get is the same thing that everyone gets. Hopefully, protection from our enemies and, you know, a stable government and a tax-based system and so on. You know, in other words, I'm not getting any of that, but these people are. And I'm not saying that that's not right. I'm just simply saying, let's weigh in all of the facts, all of the criteria. In 2012, before I leave that number there, that is more than double. That $750 billion is more than double from what it was in 2001. It was $320 billion in 2001. In 2012, $80 billion in food stamps alone were handed out by the United States government. $80 billion in free food. That's impressive. I mean, I challenge anyone to go back in history and look how much any government has ever handed out to its people in the form of free food in a single year that would amount to that. That's something to think about and to take into consideration. Not only that, but we also have a number of local programs, local welfare programs that are available in virtually any American city, and these things are unprecedented in human history. We have food banks, we have soup kitchens, we have public housing, we have free medical clinics, free emergency room care, and so on and so on. Not only that, but the typical home in America is larger and better furnished than many of the poor in foreign countries and for most of human history, when multiple families had to live under one roof and they didn't have modern conveniences like what we have today. And many of the poor today have creature comforts and amenities and higher standard of living than most of those poor throughout really all of human history. I mean, even though people are poor today, a lot of those people who are deemed poor fall into that 35 million category there that I mentioned earlier. They have cars. A lot of them have air conditioning if they need it. They have cell phones, personal computers, cable TV, a number of them anyway, big screen TV, entertainment centers, microwaves, dishwashers, washers and dryers, and so on. You start adding all that up, and you start looking at who the poor really are. You start asking yourself, I think it really is poor is what the gospel was talking about when it talked about the poor. I'm not saying it's not. I'm just asking you to think about the big picture here. What used to be luxuries a couple decades ago is now commonplace and standard. I want you to think about this, and you might have to do a little research if you weren't alive then or if you don't know anything about this. Look at the year 1933 in the middle of the Depression and the Dust Bowl in particular, and look at what poor people then had to live off of, and look at what amenities poor people then had in their homes. Look at what they had to live on, and look at what they had as far as creature comforts, and compare that now, that was 70 years ago, compare that now to 2013, and a typical poor family or poor household, and what those two families had. They're both poor, but one has far, far more than the other one ever had. That's something to take into account also. And the fact is, too, and this is a sad note, that many of those who are poor choose to spend their money on things that really don't help themselves, like alcohol or cigarettes and things like that. In fact, sometimes they spend that the money for those things from the money that was given to them by the government that was supposed to go to their food. That sounds very depressing, all of this, in a way. But my point here is that the average poor family does not represent every poor family. And there are a number of different levels of poverty even within those who are considered poor. That's not often what we hear, and I believe, and you might say, that's your opinion. Okay, I won't even grant it as my opinion. I believe that that is intentional. I believe that this is part of a political propaganda here. Liberal advocacy groups want you to believe that poverty is a huge epidemic, but this is often a bunch of hype and propaganda, and there is a huge conflict of interest. They want you to vote and support their government-funded programs because that brings more money into the government, into the bureaucracy, and less money out of your pocket. That's called conflict of interest. In other words, we're not just being noble and virtuous and we want to help people. It's because what we really want is money and power. And if we were to take that out of the picture and then start helping the poor, we would look at this much differently. That's kind of what we're being faced with. The news media, for example, will focus on some isolated, desperate family living in a tent by the side of the road and or in squalor in some way, and they'll say, this is poverty, and 35 million Americans live in poverty. But you're looking at two very different pictures. That's called false extrapolation. When you take a single incident and you extrapolate it multitudes of times over a vast number of people that don't necessarily fit that first characteristic. Are there people living in tents by the side of the road or in squalor? Yes, there's no question of that. Are all 35 million Americans who are deemed in poverty by the U.S. Census Bureau living in tents by the side of the road in squalor? No, not hardly. But that's the picture that's being painted for us. And it's misleading and outright false. Not only that, but we tend to lump two words together, the words being poverty and deprived, or being poor and deprived, and we think they're the same thing, but they're not. If you're being deprived of a TV set and a personal computer, that's not the same thing as someone who's living under a bridge and going without dinner. Those aren't the same things. As you see on the screen, one is an economic state. That's what it means to be poor. The other is based on a false sense of entitlement. That's where you think that you should have had the computer and whatever else that you throw into that picture. You think that you should have that, but you don't, and so therefore you're deprived, and that makes you poor. But that's not right. That's not a right way of looking at that. All right, so why am I talking to you all about these things in this way? I want you to understand that poverty is not just a social issue. It is also a political issue, and it is also an emotional issue. So there's three different things we're looking at: social, political, and also emotional. And then when we start talking about, well, who are the poor? And a lot of times, not just the facts get thrown into the picture, but also our politics get thrown into it, and then our emotions get thrown into it. Try having a discussion, an open-minded, objective discussion, with all of that going on, and it makes it really difficult, doesn't it? There's all sorts of misleading numbers and exaggeration of facts, whether those misleadings are intentional or not. And this lesson, for what it's worth, is not saying you should distrust anyone who claims to be poor, because they're probably not. That's not what I'm saying whatsoever. But because that misconstrues what we are saying and why we're saying it. What I am saying to you, don't be naive. Have a good understanding of what's really going on here. Be perceptive to the situation. I'm going to state later in the lesson, but I'll state it now, that we need to be discerning as well as compassionate. Not just one or the other. We need to be discerning people. We also need to be compassionate people. I think a more accurate perspective here, a more realistic view here, is that poor are people who are unable to obtain basic nutrition, clothing, shelter, and or hygiene or sanitation. And that's a description that transcends national borders, culture, or historical eras. And that really talks about the poor in the Old Testament. They fit that description. When it talks about helping the poor or helping the needy or helping those who are without, that's really what it talks about, is those who have nowhere else to go. And they don't have government handouts to help them. They have no family to help them. They live daily by begging, or what we call a hand-to-mouth existence. And they're seldom do they own more than the clothes on their back or what they could fit in a knapsack. That's poor. And there are poor people in America today who do fit that description. And they are desperate. And they are in survival mode. And we should not be oblivious to that. And we should not think that, well, because there's so many scammers and bogus situations out there, that somehow takes away from those who are genuinely poor. You know, there's a lot of people out there holding cardboard signs up by the on-ramps to a freeway. You know, help me, I'm in need, and so on. And maybe some of those are legitimate. Probably most of those are just a big scam. And that's been proven more than once. A lot of that's just bogus. And that sours us sometimes, because then we think, well, then everyone that's doing that is scamming us. And that's just not true. In my opinion, for what it's worth, we should not or do not need to wait until people get to that extreme before we can help. That situation of being desperate and in survival mode. Maybe poor isn't always the right word in that case, because sometimes people face hard times and they just need help. And sometimes they need your help in getting through that hard time. So we're not saying, well, the problem is not really there until you're absolutely desperate and you've exhausted all other opportunities in every other way. At the same time, remembering the poor doesn't mean that those to whom you give help have to be brought up to your standard of living. Like you have to give everything that you have until everything's equal, which we talked about last week. Okay? And there's an attitude there of a political attitude there of you know the equalization of all possessions and all wealth. The redistribution of wealth. So that's not true. That's not necessary. In fact, when we have parents who give to their children everything that the parents have, what did the children turn out to be? Good, upright citizens, right? No, spoiled little brats is what they turn out to be. And what do spoiled little brats grow up to be? Spoiled adults. Expecting everyone to hand things to them. Entitled, in their opinion, to every blessing or gift or benefit that's out there. That's not healthy. That's not good. Now imagine a whole society of spoiled little children having grown up to spoiled adults that think that everything should be handed to them by the government, for example. And what you're getting closer to is where America is heading toward right now. The poor, in Galatians chapter 2, verse 10, where we derive this very last week's lesson, where Paul said, remember the poor, which I was eager to do. That word poor there actually comes from a Greek word which literally refers to or literally means those who crouch or those who cower. And it depicts the posture of one who is begging. You know, someone holding up a can or something, some kind of receptacle there and is begging with their head down, which is typically what you see in ancient history, of course, the depiction of those who are poor. And you can see that in a lot of different countries even today. So it doesn't refer to those who choose to be poor because they neglected their responsibilities or because they live foolishly, but likely what Paul is referring to is, first of all, Christians who have been abandoned or have been ostracized as a direct result of their faith in Christ. In other words, because they chose to become Christians, their family abandoned them, they were cut off from society. If they were part of a trade guild or what we call today a union, a labor union, they would be cut off from that because now they won't give their token tithe or obligation to the patron god of that union, because all the guilds had gods and there was a lot of paganism involved in that. And now a Christian can't participate in that, and so he's cut off. You used to be a welder, you used to be an electrician, and I know they didn't have those then, but I'm saying, and you used to be a truck driver or whatever else, and now the union's cut you off and you can't do that anymore. What are you going to do now? Well, you're going to learn a new trade, or you're going to beg. Or you're going to, hopefully, other Christians will come to your aid. It also refers to victims of circumstances beyond their control. I'll talk more about that here in just a minute. But in particular, at that time in history, it would refer to drought, or famine, or runaway inflation, or robbery, or things such as that. And those things were real. Those things really did happen. Or refer to missionaries who deserve to be supported. In 3 John verse 7, because there's only one chapter there, John talks about strangers who went out for the sake of the name, and he's talking about the name of Christ, accepting nothing from the Gentiles, another word for unbelievers, and John says, therefore we ought to support such men. In other words, what he's saying there is that there are some men, and probably women as well, who chose to become missionaries for the sake of Christ, and they're spending their lives, they're giving their lives to the preaching of the gospel, the proclaiming the gospel, and John's coming back and saying, when those people are in town, they deserve our support because of the commitment and the sacrifice that they have made for the name. Those are the circumstances under which Paul is talking about when he talks about remembering the poor. More accurately, more biblically, more historically accurate in its context. Now, today we are rarely faced with someone who is destitute because of their religious beliefs. I'm not saying it can't happen, and I'm not saying it won't happen even in America. We're just not confronted with that directly. But we are confronted oftentimes with people who are victims of circumstances that are outside of their control. That happens. And you probably know someone of that sort. Maybe it's a family member. Maybe it's yourself. Maybe you know exactly what I'm talking about. And this is a situation like this, debilitating circumstances like a loss of a job or your job just simply evaporates. Okay? Like you used to do something. Maybe you used to make pagers. And now there are no pagers, and therefore you're out in the street looking for something else to do for a living. Or something like that. And that was a rare thing in the ancient world, your job being phased out. I mean, society didn't change for hundreds and hundreds of years. Your same job that you could have had 500 years ago was still available 500 years later. But today, in the world of technology and that rapidly changing technology at that, where everything's changing every couple years, if not faster, that can really happen. Or inflation that far outpaces cost of living increases, especially if you're on a fixed income or you have a solitary income. Or identity theft, or car theft, or home burglary, or other forms of robbery that are just debilitating. In other words, they didn't just steal your wallet, they stole everything in your house. Or they stole your house. Or they stole your identity. Okay? I mean, that stuff happens. And then they rack up thousands of dollars in bills or whatever because of what they stole. And now you're having to pay for that. And that can make you poor in a hurry. Or there are personal tragedies. And that might be the death of a breadwinner in a family, or the loss of your own personal health, or loss of an arm or a leg, or you're an accident victim leaving you debilitated, or requiring months or years of rehabilitation, or your house burns down, or, you know, that sort of thing. That's a personal tragedy. It's something that happened to you personally. But there's also something called shared tragedies, and these are things that might happen to groups of people, such as a terrorist attack. Think of 9/11, for example, or natural disasters, flooding, fire, tornado, earthquake. Those things don't just happen to one family or to one person. They happen to a lot of people. Or political or religious persecution, singling certain people out because of their beliefs. That actually happens. Or even local economic collapse as opposed to widespread. You know, economic collapse can happen in a small place, if you will. Think about Detroit, for example, and other cities across America who are declaring bankruptcy because they can't even afford to run the city. That didn't happen to all of America. Well, not yet anyway, but it did happen there, and it could happen anywhere. And you can be affected by that directly. Or we can have a crash of the entire financial system, like you had in 1929 when the stock market literally crashed. And by the way, that can happen again. So what I'm saying here is that these people are what we might determine as innocent victims. In other words, through no fault of their own, these things happen. They're suffering the consequences of these actions. These people are legitimate recipients of our help. And by the way, you don't have to go to Africa or India to find these people. I know we're real big, or people in America are real big on overseas support of those poor out there. That's noble, that's virtuous. I'm not against that at all. But you've got to understand that we've got enough poor people that need our help right here in America, that are genuinely poor, that truly are victims of circumstances beyond their control. Now, as far as who responds to this, my understanding of the scripture is that is one's own family ought to be the first to step in and help. And I say that because sometimes we get Christians who are in need, and instead of going to their family, instead of going to the relatives that they should be going to, they go to the church and they say, "Can you help us?" And really, we have just the opposite situation being described for us, such as in 1 Timothy 5, verse 3 and 4. Paul says, honor widows. And by honor, he means financially support widows, who are widows indeed. He's talking to Timothy to bring this information to whatever church he's teaching at. But if any widow has children or grandchildren, the grandchildren must first learn to practice piety in regard to their own family and to make some return to their parents. For this is acceptable in the sight of God. And he goes on to say later in that passage that we shouldn't burden the church with things that can be easily taken care of by family. So it's a family's responsibility to step in first in these situations. Now, there are times when no one has family, or you know, your family's just as broke as you are. Okay, that'll happen. Can happen. But you need to go to those people first. They're supposed to help you out. That's the God-given principle that we're given. This is a principle that extends well past the subject that's immediately being covered. And that's something to think about as well. And now I want to talk about something that the media won't tell you so often or at all. Another reason why people become poor is because they don't exercise good stewardship. This is called mismanagement of your money or your resources or your life, really. And the media tends to avoid this because they want us to feel sorry for the poor people because they're poor so that they can get our votes and they can get our support of their government programs, which comes back to money and power. You say, well, that's your opinion. All right, that's my opinion, even though it's usually true. But my point here is that this is something that's often avoided. And these are people who are failing to exercise good judgment and or restraint regarding their own money and their resources. And that includes all the things, at least, that you see on the screen. Sometimes people make unwise investments, which is secretly a subterfuge for foolish investments, okay? Sometimes people put their money in really foolish things. And then, to their surprise, the foolish thing evaporates and they're left with no money. That happens. Sometimes people's spending habits exceed their income. Sometimes people fail to live within a budget. Sometimes people are prone to impulsive or excessive spending. They're just spending money because they have it. Or they're spending money because they like spending money. Or they're shopping because they like shopping, that sort of thing. And then that leads to often credit card debt. I am told by those who are in the mortgage industry, who I happen to know, that when they look over these financial documents of people that are looking for like refinancing and so on, the credit card debt of many families, $15,000 is not unusual. $15,000 in credit card debt when you're paying 19 to 23% interest per month, that'll sink you in a hurry. That's debilitating. But nobody twisted your arm to put everything on that credit card, did they? That's called poor stewardship. If you're getting in that kind of debt, really because of your own decision. But it happens. And then there's people who fail to provide for large expenses like taxes, car insurance premiums, home repairs, auto repairs. Those are things that are going to happen, and you need to provide for those. You need to plan ahead for those. Set money aside for those so that when they happen, they don't just completely evaporate everything that you have on hand. All of these things, and we could add to this list if we wanted to, they fall into the category of poor stewardship. When we're talking about stewardship, we're talking about management. And ideally, in a positive way, we're talking about good management of the blessings and resources that God has given you. When we're talking about poor stewardship, we're talking about mismanaging those same things. And this is a huge subject by itself, and I'm not trying to go into all that in this one lesson, but I'm just trying to say that those things happen. I'm not excusing it either. I'm trying to say that these things shouldn't be happening, but they happen even among Christians. Now, on the other side of that, that doesn't mean that people aren't allowed to make mistakes. I think all of us have made mistakes. Probably all of us are on that list in some way or another at some time in our life. We made one of those miscalculations, those poor judgments, those dumb decisions, whatever it might be. We did that. People are allowed to make mistakes. And we're not allowed, as those who maybe aren't making those mistakes right then, we're not allowed to go in then and punish those people by withholding help. Everyone makes mistakes, but we're supposed to learn from those mistakes and not perpetuate them. And this is, in my understanding, where the road divides right here. Here's someone who's made a couple mistakes or made a mistake, and he's reeling from that, and he's asking for help. That's one thing. But here's another person who made that same mistake or made another mistake like it and then kept making another mistake like it and kept doing that, and it becomes a lifestyle. And he's also asking for our help. Which one of those two people should we help? That's what I'm asking you to think about. There are those who make mistakes, and they need a one-time or a very rare bailout, for lack of a better term. And then there are those who are chronically and financially irresponsible. Those people need to learn how to manage their life. They don't need just a check from you or a cash donation, because they're just going to spend that just as irresponsibly as they spend everything else. What they really need to do is be sat down and taught how to govern their money, how to have a budget and live in that budget. They need to be retrained, in other words. And actually, you might do more harm than good by handing them a donation, because all you're doing now is just enabling them to continue down that path. Well, while we're on the subject of enabling, we who are Christians are not to enable those who refuse to take responsibility for themselves or for their families. There's a passage, this is out of 2 Thessalonians chapter 3 and verse 10. Paul says, "For even when we are with you, we used to give you this order, if anyone is not willing to work, then he is not to eat either." Now, that's what the Bible teaches. And that is very as much usable today as it was in Paul's day with regard to the Thessalonians. And the incident there was, you know, the people then at that time believed that Jesus would come at any time, so they sold off all their possessions and they sat around in other people's living rooms waiting for the Lord to come. Meanwhile, they get hungry. And then they want the people whose living room they're sitting in to feed them. And then this goes on day after day, week after week. And news of this reaches Paul's ears, and he's saying, wait a minute. That's called irresponsible. You need to have a job and pay for your own stuff. And if you're not going to work, then you shouldn't be eating either. Get out on the street if that's what it takes. In other words, there has to be consequences to our poor decisions. Otherwise, we don't learn from the poor decisions. He says, basically, you're not to feed those people. And you look at that and you say, well, that's strong language. It is strong language. I didn't say it. I'm just agreeing to it, okay? But it's not only is it strong, but it's also biblical and it's also very practical. We cannot be party to laziness or carelessness or rebellion in any form, because that is a passive form of rebellion, isn't it? If God tells you to be responsible and earn a wage and work quietly with your hands so that you can afford your own bread and have something to give to someone else, I'm putting together several different verses there that talk about those things. If that's what God says and you go, nah, I don't want to do that, I just want to live this way, that's called passive rebellion. You're not saying, oh, God is wrong. That's active rebellion. What you're saying is, I just don't want to do that. And that's not any better, really, than active rebellion. Here's a couple of things to think about. First of all, no one, as far as I understand the Bible to teach, no one is entitled to live irresponsibly, no matter how rich or poor they are. No one is entitled to live that way. And along with that, and this is probably a summation of this whole lesson as if you were to encapsulate it in this way, no one is allowed to choose to be poor. If poverty happens to you, it's something that you didn't choose. It's something that happened to you. But if you choose to be poor, well, then you made your own bed, so to speak. Okay? I'm not saying that we can't help you at all or that people can't help you at all. I'm just saying that you have to understand that you created that situation. It didn't just happen to you. You made it happen to you. I want to turn a corner here in our lesson for just a few moments. Christians who have been blessed by God to share with others, we have a responsibility to remember the poor. That was last week's lesson. But those who are genuinely poor also have responsibilities, and often we neglect to talk about this. Maybe it's because we don't want to offend those people who are poor. Maybe it sounds cold to say that, hey, I know that you're poor, I know that you're impoverished, but you still have to be responsible. Maybe it's to those people that sounds cold and harsh and uncaring, but it's not. Just because someone becomes financially destitute doesn't mean that he or she has no obligations of his own. If they're a Christian especially, they're still held to their professed allegiance to Christ. They're still held morally responsible as a believer. Right? You know, one disservice our government has done for us, remember I told you they're spending last year $750 billion in services, and that's fine in itself. We're not trying to put a price on what the government should or shouldn't do. But at the same time, in what's happening in some of those cases, maybe more than we even know about, is that the government is actually lifting all the responsibilities off of certain poor people and accepting them or taking them on themselves, the government, that is. And that's not what we're told to do. We're not told to lift responsibilities off of people. We're told to help them with their responsibilities. We're told to help them through their responsibilities. We're not told to remove their responsibilities. I read nowhere in the New Testament, for example, where I'm told to take all the responsibilities of my brother in Christ and accept them for myself. Are you? Are you ever told to take someone else's cross from their shoulder and bear it yourself, and then they are crossless? They can now walk around without a cross? Are you ever taught that? Are you ever told to do that? I'm going to save you some time. No, you're not. Okay? But there is that attitude out there that says that, well, these people, they need our help, and so we're going to help them by lifting all the responsibility from them. And that doesn't help them. That teaches them to trust in people who lift all their responsibilities from them. That's called enabling, once again. It's not a good thing. Yeah, consider a couple passages out of the Old Testament. Leviticus 19, verse 15. God says, "You shall do no injustice in judgment. You shall not be partial to the poor, nor defer to the great, but you are to judge your neighbor fairly." You say, what does that have to do with the poor financially? Well, financially not so much, except that what he's really saying there is that you're not to favor the poor just because they're poor. You're supposed to favor them because there is a need there, and you are there to fulfill that. But you're not to favor judgment for the poor and always against the rich because the poor are poor and the rich are rich. There's supposed to be an equality of justice. If the poor person got caught stealing something, well, then he needs to bear the consequences of his crime. And same for the rich person. And if the poor man is innocent, then he needs to have that innocence validated by a jury of his own peers or the elders of the city or whatever. And so with the rich man. That's what he's talking about. And here's another occasion in Exodus chapter 30, verse 15. And he's talking about the half shekel ransom payment that was to be paid at the numbering of Israel, which happened twice in the book of Numbers and is being described here in Exodus. The rich shall not pay more, and the poor shall not pay less than the half shekel when you give the contribution to the Lord to make atonement for yourselves. In other words, what is he saying? The rich have their share, poor have their share. It's all equal. Not favoring one or the other. What I'm getting at here is that we cannot elevate the poor to sainthood by assuming too much. Not all those who are poor are undeserving of their poverty. Some of those people live irresponsibly. Some of those have been stiff-arming and shunning good advice for years, and they put themselves in their situation. At the same time, just because someone is not poor means that they need to feel guilty because they're not poor. God blesses us and he wants us to be thankful for the blessings. He doesn't want us to be guilty because we've been blessed. Now, with blessing comes responsibility, right? Which is what we were talking about last week. But it's not true that I have to feel guilty because I have more than maybe you have. Or that you should feel guilty because you have maybe more than I have. You should consider yourself blessed. And I hope that you're managing with good stewardship those blessings in a way that is appropriate and consistent with Scripture. So, to summarize that point there, we should not think that all the rich people are automatically wicked and untrustworthy, and all poor people are automatically sincere and pure in heart, because neither extreme is true. And we are warned against making such extreme judgments or assumptions or stereotypes. I think this is a good point that we don't get to very often. Okay? And as far as spiritual responsibilities are concerned, you don't have to be wealthy or even middle income to fulfill Christian obligations. For example, in Romans chapter 12, verse 9 and following, Paul gives really a scenario of what it is that we're to do as Christians. And he says, well, you're to love without hypocrisy, abhor what is evil, cling to what is good, be fervent in service, persevere in tribulation, be devoted to prayer, contribute to the needs of the saints, practice hospitality, bless those who persecute you, weep with those who weep, rejoice with those who rejoice. Those are things that we're all told to do. And you recognize there that, as it says on the screen, these actions are not necessarily dependent upon any financial status or ability. Now, someone might come back and they say, well, contributing to the needs of the saints, practicing hospitality, those seem to be an exception. But only if you put a dollar amount on it. Can you contribute to the needs of the saints without spending any money? Of course you can. You could spend your time. You could spend your labor. You could spend your own personal effort. And that's contributing, practicing hospitality. Maybe you can't invite someone over for a meal because you're struggling to feed yourself. But you can practice hospitality in other ways. Even praying for someone else is a hospitable act. The point I'm trying to make here is that there, good deeds don't really cost anything to provide in all cases. Sometimes they do, but sometimes they don't. And just because someone is poor or financially destitute in whatever way or destitute in other ways doesn't mean that we alleviate them from all their moral obligations to God. The point I'm making here is that those who are poor, if indeed they are poor, they ought not to sit still and let everyone come to them while they sit there and do nothing. Especially those who are Christians. There's always plenty to do, especially within the community of believers. There's always plenty to do. Now, my intent in this lesson is to be fair and balanced, to give an overview of who are the poor. I'm not trying to be critical of someone who is genuinely in need. And at the same time, I want you to recognize, and you need to recognize, that not all needs are equal, and not all what someone describes as a need obligates you. Because remember, it comes back to, well, it depends who you ask, and it also depends on the motive. Why the question is being asked. Remember, I talked to you about that earlier in the lesson. Those things play into that. We live in a society that is saturated with feel-good media propaganda, and it loves to sensationalize human interest stories, but it seldom focuses on personal and moral responsibility, especially moral responsibility to God. And that is sad, but that's where we're at. That's the society that we live in. And even so, even having said all that, the poor will always be among us. And at times, some of us may be among the poor. So we dare not turn a blind eye to them. We dare not close our heart to them. And we dare not distrust every plea for help. My strong advice to you is if you are given a situation where you are unable to determine whether it is genuine or not, better to err on the side of mercy. I would rather be charged with being merciful than being charged with being tight-fisted and cold and uncaring. Wouldn't you? Err on the side of mercy. Let God sort out all the details later on. If that person really did defraud you, if they really did just hoodwink you, and if their situation really is bogus and you gave to it anyway, let God compensate you in His good time and let God deal with that person in His good time. And those situations are going to happen, by the way. Let me turn your attention to something else as we close here. Jesus talking to the church of Smyrna there in Revelation chapter 2, verse 9. He says to them, he says, I know your tribulation and your poverty. In other words, it's real. You really are in tribulation and you really are poor, but you are rich. So which is it? Are you poor or are you rich? Well, financially, these people are poor, but they're rich in fellowship with God. And that to Jesus, not to me, I wasn't the one saying it, but that to Jesus is far more important than any financial wealth a person might have. In other words, what Jesus is saying in so many words is the world is filled with problems, it's filled with troubles, it's filled with times of desperation, yes, even with persecution. But your spiritual fellowship with God is not dependent upon the removal of those things, because it actually transcends all those things. I don't have to take all those things away from you in order for you to be faithful to God. Rather, what he has said elsewhere in Matthew 6, verse 19 through 21, is don't store up your treasures here on earth anyway. Store them up in heaven. Because that's where you're heading, I hope, if indeed you are in fellowship with God. So, Jesus never apologized for their situation. Have you noticed that? Jesus never apologized to anyone because he hasn't done anyone any wrong. And secondly, he never said, but I'm going to send you a government bailout. Or I'll send you some food stamps. Or I'll send you a check in the mail. I'm going to take away your poverty. I'm going to send you some money. He never said that. What he did say was, be faithful until death, and I will give you the crown of life. Now, that doesn't diminish the struggle that they're going through. And it doesn't ignore it either. It transcends it. It says, basically, there's something more important going on here than what you're struggling with right now in the here and now. There's something far more important, and you need to fixate on that thing that is far more important. So this morning, whether you are rich or poor, great or small, having an abundance or in want, all of those factors that I just mentioned are limited to this life and the physical realm. Your soul is going to outlive all of them. What you really need to do is be prepared for what is coming. I'm not talking about the economic, storm that we're all being threatened with. I'm talking about the end of your life and the end of the world and your presentation before God. If you're ready for that, then you are rich indeed. If you're prepared for that, if you've made or planned with good stewardship to be prepared for that event, standing before God, well, then you've taken care of the most important things first. And that's really what Jesus is wanting us to see. Real wealth is spiritual life with God. If there's anyone here that is subject to that invitation, because that was your invitation, if you need to respond to that, then this would be your time to come forward as we stand and sing the song that Jeff has selected for us.